big topics, big ideas, and practical policy solutions. This is Leaders on the Frontier with your host, David Leese.
Hi, everybody. It's David Leese, and it's great to see everybody. This is our live discussion on both YouTube and X, and we're so delighted that you could join us today. We've got an extraordinary guest joining us today about a very important topic, and it's hard to believe that it's April 19, 2024. And so my question today is, do you remember the date? It was called January 2020, and that's when we first learned in many respects about a virus that was going to change, some would argue, the world forever. And what was the collateral damage? Well, we're going to examine that question in a moment. And I want to share with you more about an amazing documentary about that very topic.
To spread, so does fear.
Stay home.
Shelter in place.
Locking down is not only the only tool, it's the best tool.
The public did not know that there were prominent scientists that disagreed with the lockdown policies.
Across the country, 2,200 cases.
That number's gonna skyrocket.
This is moving very fast.
The federal government was regularly censoring dissenting opinions.
They wanted to create an illusion of consensus.
This hurt a lot of people.
We're being told not to contradict any kind of public health orders at the risk of losing our license.
Suddenly, just boom, you're fired and no explanation.
I'm giving you 90 days notice of termination between the health authority and yourself.
This goes all the way back to January 2020.
About 3.4% of reported COVID-19 cases have died.
I knew immediately that was a vast exaggeration.
It was starting to look more and more like we had misunderstood what the infection fatality rate was going to look like.
If you're going to make a case for lockdown, you absolutely need to know how widespread the disease is and how deadly it is.
I was asked to be an advisor to the president during the biggest healthcare crisis in a century. Fauci, the task force, were instilling panic in the public instead of articulating the data.
The entire world, country after country, copied what China had done. Absolutely insane.
This was shocking to me. In a free society, to simply decree the lockdowns.
We wanted to tell the world that there was an alternate view that prominent scientists had.
A group of more than 40 epidemiologists and public health scientists reject closing economies.
The National Institute of Health called for a devastating published takedown, engaged the press in mere jobs and hit pieces.
The federal government was working with Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, all of them, to be able to manipulate the public.
Musk has released an incriminating stream of internal documents.
It's just the most damning discovery.
Twitter said they don't want people to hear what I said.
I was blacklisted the day I joined Twitter.
The Stanford professor, physician who specializes in this stuff, seems like he'd be the last person who'd censor, correct?
At the highest levels, people that we've trusted to be knowledgeable are not. They're simply not.
The COVID lockdowns caused catastrophic damage to the world.
Breaking overdose numbers,
the rise in suicidal
rates of depression way up among children.
This is from the isolation of the lockdowns. This is nothing to do with the virus itself.
We became focused on the prevention of a single threat. And as a result, we threw away everything else that we might care about.
19-year-old Kai Matthews needed the ER right away.
We were denied treatment because of COVID.
They said, we can't chance COVID exposure at the hospital.
Several hours later, Kai passed away from meningitis B.
Are we a society that sacrifices our children?
This whole lockdown philosophy makes us fundamentally change our civilizations. And it will come back over and over again unless we as a society decide that we do not want to live this way.
Well, that was the trailer to an amazing documentary called COVID Collateral. And with me here to talk about that documentary that's soon to be released in May is the producer, the journalist, Vanessa Dillon. I want a warm welcome to you, Vanessa, today to talk about it. I was just really quite touched by this documentary. I think it's the most powerful summation about the COVID-19 story the last several years. And I want to congratulate you and your incredible team for pulling off that documentary. And I just want to encourage people to see it, but well done. And I know that you're a Emmy-nominated producer, so we're really delighted to have you for this discussion today.
Thank you so much, David. I'm very flattered, and I hope I can I hope I can live up to that intro.
Well, Vanessa, the proof is in the pudding, and you really hit it out of the ballpark with this documentary. So I'm really looking forward to the larger response, not only within Canada, but around the world, to really the long overdue storytelling regarding this, based on very much the evidence that we have now, the receipts, if you will. And I think that it not only represents an accomplishment in terms of storytelling, the heartfelt impacts on people, families, everybody, but also the research, the in-depth research that you and your team have undertaken. So I want to start off by our discussion here, and I certainly want to welcome our audience today to think about their questions as well. We'd love to hear from you. I want to begin with the question, Vanessa, why did you undertake this project?
I undertook it against my better judgment. Because
against
I knew
your
I was
better judgment.
Against my better judgment, because I knew I was going to be pilloried and I was going to face a lot of hostility if I went through with it. But before I start a film, I ask myself the question, what does the public need to know about this topic that they don't know? If I make this film, will it serve the public good? So I felt I had enough meat on the bones 2 years ago to start working on it. And I began working on it for several reasons. First of all, I perceived very early on, in the very early stages of lockdowns, that there were public policies that made absolutely no sense to me. For example, small business owners were had to shut down their businesses. They had to declare bankruptcy while the big box stores stayed open. So it appears that if you went to your local hardware store and bought a hammer, you could get COVID, but you wouldn't get COVID if you bought it at Best Buy. You know, and if you went to your local bakery and bought a croissant, you could get COVID, but not at Costco. So and I noticed everyone was still shopping at these big box stores, but the kids were out of school. The kids were forced to learn at home, which is, let's face it, online learning for children, it doesn't work. So I noticed there was an inequality of burden also amongst people. So I noticed that there were an entire laptop class that could continue working from home, get government workers, related government workers could just stay at home and have their kids there. And some of them had the means to take the kids to the cottage, etc. So I'm not saying that they didn't suffer. All I'm saying is that there was some upheaval, but not to the extent that lower income people across Canada and the US experienced. These are the people that actually had to show up to get paid. They were the ones that were stocking shelves. I'm talking pre-vaccine here. These were the people that drove trucks across borders so that people like us could eat. People who stocked shelves, as I said, people who worked in warehouses, so that we could get our Amazon packages. So I noticed that there was an entire class of people that was bearing this burden disproportionately. Mm-hmm. And I also noticed, and what convinced me that a film should be made, was that there were some very prominent scientists early on in 2020 that were claiming that there was an alternative to lockdowns, that there was not enough of a scientific basis for society to lock down. People such as Jay Bhattacharya and Martin Kulldorff and Sunetra Gupta, who ended up forming the Great Barrington Declaration. These people were not fringe scientists, yet the head of the NIH, Dr. Francis Collins at the time, sent an email to Dr. Fauci saying, we've got to shut this down right now, these fringe epidemiologists. Well, the fringe epidemiologists were leaders in their field. Oxford, Stanford, Harvard. These were very reliable people. And they were asking the question, on what scientific basis are we locking down? And then you had people such as Scott Atlas, who President Trump at the time, because Scott Atlas had claimed that we had a pandemic plan in place already since 2006. The Western world had this plan written up by a number of very distinguished epidemiologists that said, in the case of a pandemic, you protect the most vulnerable people, but the rest of society should just go on about its business prudently, but go on about its business. This was completely taken down. It was just thrown out. Also at the time, we realized that the WHO was advocating lockdown. So this put pressure on all Western countries to lock down. But we also knew at the time, and when I'm speaking now, I'm not speaking with 2020 hindsight after 4 years, I'm talking about what we knew at that time. So in 2020, we knew that China had a disproportionate influence on the WHO. Mm-hmm. We also know that China lied to us and said, we shut down in Wuhan. Look at us. It's been 1 month. This virus is gone. Mm-hmm. Why we would believe that, I don't know. We have in North America the top scientists.
I think, Vanessa, you summarize it so well. I mean, you are based in Canada, and you see all these things going on that are in plain view. You can go to Walmart, but you can't go to your corner bakery, or let alone your church or your synagogue or your temple. I mean, there's all these obvious contradictions, and it's not like we were not aware of the importance in public health of protecting the vulnerable. And so it is kind of a head scratcher, but we do know a lot now of evidence. And I think you do a masterful job of pointing out things that, I mean, it's almost like we're going to have to peel the perennial onion here as we go through the documentary and highlight some points. But I think that's a very interesting summary, as you recall it. And so tell us more about who you are. Like, you have worked with really quite prominent leaders around the world, like I'm not sure if I certainly well known the artist Sting, the musician, to all kinds of major documentaries, from the human brain to microplastics. I mean, you've got a very impressive resume. So that's why I asked the question, how did you get engaged to take on this documentary? Because you must have known there would have been a lot of pushback.
Yes. It was, I suppose in the end, even though I knew certain facts, even though certain things didn't make sense to me, and I knew that there were these top scientists saying, look, there, you know, we threw the pandemic playbook out. Why are we doing this? So even though I knew that there was a certain politicization of science going on, and that's what interested me in terms of the angle of the film. But I guess the reason I really dove in was I saw suffering around me. Mm. I don't mean within my own family, because we all did fine. But the idea that people were dying alone really bothered me. Terminally ill patients, elderly patients were, first of all, isolated during COVID. And also that when they died, their families, and this happened in many, many cases across Canada and the US, their families were forced to say goodbye to them through an iPad or an iPhone. And I couldn't conceive of not being at my mother's bedside if she were ill or dying. And I thought to myself, can you imagine being old and sick and dying and not seeing your children, not seeing your spouse,
horrible,
not having someone comfort you? And I thought, that's what bothered me the most. And I thought, this is the most cruel and inhumane act. And yet, it's happening.
You know, I think that's just a stunning point, is that you, like so many of us, saw the incredible, it's a horrible term in a way, the collateral damage, the impact on real people around these decisions. And so, again, I think this documentary is going to make an incredible wave, because it's hard to really understand what all happened unless you kind of understand the story of how it all unfolded. And how, I don't like to use this term very often, but it's just so many lies that were made, and we see the receipts now in retrospect, don't we? Was that a revelation for you as well? Like, there were so many things that they asserted, different authorities, and it seems like a lot of this was really coordinated. It wasn't like an organic event. Is that your conclusion? Like, do I sound too much like a paranoid conspiracy theorist? But that's not what happened, is it?
No, I think because science became politicized, I think overall, because there were too many interests there. There were too many organizations that had certain interests. And when I talk about the politicization of science, I'm not only talking about lockdowns but I'm also talking about the questions around the origin of this virus. In the past, whenever a virus had an animal origin, that animal origin was located. People knew bird flu came from X source. We always knew that. However, in this case, an animal source was never found. Even though Dr. Fauci and his scientists cooked up this paper about the evolutionary source of this virus. Mm-hmm. Well, there was no evolutionary source. They were never able to find it.
So you're referring to the so-called questions around the origins of COVID-19, and specifically the theory that somehow this occurred naturally in nature, that it came from bats. And it came from, say, a, quote, wet market in Wuhan, China. And, of course, the bat caves are several hundred kilometers removed from Wuhan. And it's fascinating, because now we see the email chatter, literally, that had to be released legally under subpoena and evidence from these different decision makers, saying we're really concerned that we essentially squelched discussion around the real origins of this. We've got to protect the idea that it came from the Wuhan lab, and let's push the button to essentially do a campaign of information that it came from some bat soup or something like that. That's really what you're referring to, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. So there were a number of scientists that were able to decode this genome of the virus, and they were able to see that there's this thing there called a furin cleavage. Now, I'm not sure what that is, but apparently it's an indication that the virus was tampered with, that it was manipulated in a lab. And the reason the entire lab theory was squelched by Tony Fauci and his group was that Tony Fauci, and this was not a secret, but it certainly the public wouldn't have known about it. Tony Fauci's NIAID, his institute, had been funding coronavirus research in China for many years.
He'd actually been funding it.
He had been funding it.
And that was actually against the law.
It was at the time. There was a kind of loophole. I mean, during the Obama administration, it was banned because it was considered very dangerous research, which it is. Mm-hmm. Because what you do in gain of function research is you take a relatively harmless virus and you make it more powerful. You make it more pathogenic. And so the reason you do that is if you're being benevolent, is that you are going to create a vaccine for it. If it actually does become powerful, you have a vaccine ready. But it is very dangerous research. And Dr. Fauci's organization and the FBI knew that for years, this research had been going on and that it was dangerous and that It was not out of the question that this virus could have leaked, because the Wuhan Institute of Virology is a level 4 biohazardous lab, but the Chinese are a little bit careless. They don't exactly care about human safety, and they had been operating the lab under a level 2. And that is your local, and that is your average dental office. So they were so concerned about a possible leak for years that Peter Daszak, who was the UK scientist who had been organizing the collaboration between the Chinese and the US scientists, he petitioned the National Institutes of Health for insurance in case of a lab leak. That's not in the film. This is just a little bit of the backstory.
But that is fascinating background. I hadn't understood that. You know, what's amazing about this, Vanessa, and I know that you referenced this in the documentary, is the incredible messaging. It was obviously a highly coordinated information campaign that would label anyone who is off official message, including the origins of the virus from the Wuhan lab, as a conspiracy theorist. And obviously, in retrospect, that's clearly wrong. There's so many official reports now, whether it's from the US Department of Energy, the FBI. I mean, there's a myriad of reports now. And it's interesting, I believe just yesterday, the publication Science just issued an apology that came forward saying it apologized for its inability to really get at that issue and look at the options, including the whole notion that it was actually from the Wuhan lab. So that actually gives me a bit of a glimmer of hope that there could be some redemption here, that people are actually being held to a self-account or even apologizing for calling people conspiracy. It's really quite astounding. Have you noticed this as well?
Yes, and I think actually what is helpful in the film, and again, to your point about people being held to account, is the Senate subcommittee hearings into the origin of the virus in Washington that have been going on now for at least a year, and they have been barbecuing people on that. Pardon? In that they
Sorry,
have been
barbecuing?
They have been grilling people.
Grilling them.
They have been grilling people, such as Fauci and his, such as Dr. Fauci and his entourage of scientists, who had, in a sense, conspired to change the message about COVID having possibly escaped from a lab. So these subcommittee hearings, I think, are extremely revelatory.
They really are. And I think the whole question of the origins of COVID-19 are important. And I should just remind the audience that I am speaking with the producer director of an amazing documentary. It's soon to be released in May. And we'll get to a moment in about the whole question of releasing the documentary. But this is Vanessa Dillon. She's a well-known master of documentary. So I'm really glad that you can join us, Vanessa. So we welcome your questions, audience. And but the whole issue of the origins of COVID-19, I think, was well described within your documentary in a very particular way. And I think it was well put, is that it's almost like the images, the horrible images coming in from China in those early days, very much seeded the ground in our minds. Not only what was happening, the idea that this is somehow a catastrophe. This is like the Spanish flu with a very high mortality rate. But it was the emotion of fear. And because it's interesting, China, like any other participant of the World Health Organization, signs a protocol that any kind of nasty bug like this needs to be reported within 24 hours. And yet they didn't do that. They didn't share those results. So I think what struck me is that in the documentary, you seem to be making the point that this was really well orchestrated so that we really didn't know the full statistics, as if you believe the stats coming out of there, so that we would kind of be disoriented. Is that the point that you were trying to make?
Yes. And also, I mean, China, we know that China is not friendly to Western countries. Mm-hmm. They are not an ally. We do business with them, but we do know that they are hostile when it comes to intellectual property, that they are the spy masters of intellectual property. And we know that they do tend to lie. They are not known for being transparent. We do know that COVID had been circulating in China mm-hmm. in 2019. And there were a number of scientists in China who were whistleblowers, and they were quickly disposed of by the Communist Party. There is.
Pardon me. What do you mean by disposed of?
They were not seen. They were not seen afterwards. I don't know what happened.
They disappeared.
So whether they disappeared as in were executed or they were just kept in solitary somewhere, I have no idea. But we do know that the whistleblowers in China disappeared. There's also one very, very strange story that has some legs, because it was reported in, I believe, Senator Rubio's, and one of Senator Rubio's reports, and you really have to dig deep somewhere to find that. But the Western media did get hold of this story that one of China's top scientists, he was in his 50s, and pretty renowned scientists. He was thrown off the roof of the Wuhan lab. There was a suspicion that he was the one that had actually leaked the virus, and we do know that apparently he had taken out a patent on a COVID-19 vaccine in 2019. Now, this is down the rabbit hole of areas that we have not gone into, but this was reported in the Western media. Not well reported, but we do know that there were a lot of shenanigans happening. There was a lot of information that was being suppressed. I mean, the fact that China shut down Wuhan for a month and then declared to the West, hey, look, it's the virus is gone. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The fact that they actually did that and then they invited Western delegates mm-hmm. to Wuhan to check things out and see that, well, the virus is gone here. You know, we've done it.
No, it's really quite remarkable. I do have a question that just came up here, and that is, in your research and production of this extraordinary documentary, did you come across connections with the whole story of Canada's Level 4 lab in Winnipeg?
Not directly related to the subject of COVID, but the situation in Canada. I mean, we do know that the lab in Winnipeg is the only Level 4 biohazardous lab in Canada, which means this is the most dangerous lab. We do know that the two scientists that were working here were involved in some kind of espionage, some kind of intellectual property. That's all I know, and I don't think it's, I have no idea if it is directly related. You know, it may not be, but I think what even a lot of Western scientists that have colleagues who are Chinese, I think there is still a level of naivete about Chinese scientists, because whether the scientists themselves mean well or not, if the Chinese government tells them, you are going to spy, you are going to try to get this for us, you are going to work for us, they have no choice.
Exactly. Yeah.
They are by sheer dint of being Chinese citizens, they are in the employ of the Chinese Communist Party, and they cannot refuse. They cannot refuse any instructions.
Well, and not only that, I think there's the, Vanessa, as I recall, the dual use technology principle, and that is that any IP that flows into China is not simply for, say, commercial purposes, but by law, by penalty of death, is also reviewed by the People's Liberation Army. So there's always this dual use of anything. And it is fascinating because you referenced the delegation, I do remember that well, that did go to China later to look at this, the origins of the virus and the Wuhan lab. It was a very orchestrated, carefully managed tour. And it was interesting, one of the major leaders from the World Health Organization, that delegation, was Dr. Bruce Elward. I think he's a prominent Canadian. And I think that was a fascinating example where the messaging was really, at that time, that China was, as you say, the model for how to manage this virus. And managing it meant absolutely following the Chinese example of lockdowns. And I think that point was brilliantly made in this documentary.
Thank you. And the expert that we have that shot down Bruce Aylward's theory, simply by looking at his graph, it was Bill Shadwick, who's a master mathematician and the founder of the Fields Institute of Mathematics, which is like the gold standard of mathematics worldwide. And he says, not in the film, but he told us in an interview, he said, there are no trusted institutions any longer. He said, there are no trusted institutions any longer. And he was making a comment about the entire expert class, which is the same comment that Scott Atlas makes in our film.
Yes.
There is a level of incompetence out there that the public would, I think, feel pretty sad about.
Wow.
And Bill Shadwick makes the point in the film about the numbers that came out from the Imperial College of London, which is a highly respected institution, but its chief modeler made estimates about the potential number of deaths if we didn't lock down, and this was one of the factors that caused lockdowns, and that was the overestimation of fatalities from COVID. So in his chart, he showed that if we don't lock down in a country like the U.S., we'll probably be facing 2 million deaths within several months. Now, every epidemiologist listening would have thought, doesn't make sense. This doesn't make sense. Well, it turned out that the actual numbers after several months were just a tiny fraction of that. So we knew that these estimates were way off the charts. They were not by any reason slightly off. They were just insanely off the charts. And so the comment that Bill Chadwick makes is that he said they're just incompetent. He said the moderators at the Imperial College of London are just incompetent. And when the chief modeler admitted that his numbers were wrong, he said, I didn't expect public policy to be based on my numbers. Well, if we can't trust the expert class to get their math right, where are we supposed to go?
Indeed, and I, as I recall, Ferguson's models coming out of the Imperial College of London were really begged for second, third, and fourth opinions by peers to be able to get at this. And that, I think that was the whole point at Frontier and so many others, is said that there were so many recommendations that everyone knew lockdowns would have catastrophic impacts on every element of society. So it begs the question, any decision maker worth in their right mind would ask for a critical discussion.
Yes.
This is what you do in emergency management. But they didn't seem to do that. And if anything, they squelched the narrative. And you, again, do an incredible job in the documentary showing how they systematically censored, cajoled, they even paid thousands of people to carry the water for this corrupt message. And so when you look at this, I mean, you lived and breathed this documentary for some time. A lot of us have been doing this for years now in retrospect. What the heck really happened here? Do you have a, help us understand that question, Vanessa?
You know, I think ordinary citizens like myself, when we first heard about the lockdowns, we have faith. We have faith in our institutions. By and large, Canada works. By and large, the U.S. works. We're a Western country. And we have a certain amount of faith in our institutions, in our government, in the legal profession, in our education. But I think as time went by and we saw that there was a lack of common sense in how certain policies were implemented, I think a lot of people started to ask questions. And by the time the kids were kept out of school close to 2 years, I think there was a lot of anger and a lot of realization that public health, the public institutions have failed us. They may not have meant to fail us. I think a lot of people's hearts were in the right place. I don't think we can point fingers at our premiers, because they took their marching orders from our public health officers. And our public health officers took their marching orders from, I believe, the big movement out of the WHO. If everyone else is locking down, then maybe we should also lock down. There was a pressure right from the top, but it was a very deceptive. There was a deceptive pressure. I think society now is, and I hope, is going to be much more open to alternative opinions from good scientists.
No, I think you're absolutely right, Vanessa, and I think you really have quite extraordinary leaders who weighed in on the documentary, saying that essentially, to do science, you need an open mind, an open set of discussions that embrace those alternative views as you talk about. So this is a seminal point that, you know, really is, it hits you between the eyes when you watch this documentary, and it's all there in plain sight. And I think that one of the issues that I've found fascinating is you do quite a very interesting distinction, and this is something that came up among a number of us fairly early on, is the distinction between cases of COVID and infections. And I think that was part of the point that was made by a number of people, including Dr. Jay Bhattacharya there in the trailer, is this virus was quite widespread. But the messengers, and this was very deliberate, emphasized the cases and that mortality rate so that it would appear to be much higher, like at 3% plus, which initially I remember hearing about. I say, this is a really big problem if this is true. So what does the, it's always the devil's in the details and the statistics. And there are rules, contrary to what so many believe, there are rules around statistics. So they were playing a very manipulative game, weren't they, Vanessa?
Yes, because I'm sure that the top people, such as Anthony Fauci and the people who were responsible for decreeing lockdowns, I'm sure they all know the difference between a case fatality rate and an infection fatality rate. You know, I mean, if you have a town, let's say if you have a city of 2 million people, and mostly everyone has, you know, has antibodies or has had COVID. And we're talking about asymptomatic cases now. Many of us have had COVID. We have no idea that we've had COVID, but we have antibodies. So by the time a virus gets into a population, a sizable amount of that number of that population has already had COVID. But if you have a group of people, like 100 people of that group are hospitalized and 30 of them die or even 3 of them die, you have a high fatality rate. Mm-hmm. And that's the way the fatality rate was being reported in the news, based on the number of people that were actually sick enough to show up to a hospital.
Which is entirely misleading.
Completely.
So this is where we get into this dysfunctional public discussion now. The public's been manipulated. They think that the mortality rate is several points when in fact it's below the seasonal flu.
Exactly.
It is. But there's a particular group that is vulnerable, and we have to take that seriously and protect them. And that was the whole point of the Great Barrington Declaration. And I think that this is where it gets into really ugly issues. And you've dared to talk about it, Vanessa, where they were full bore in there, left and right, censoring people, both on social media. Government was in there directing a post, including the Canadian government now. We know that. They even vilified the people that were once celebrated, including the truckers who dared to say, look, you're going to kill our livelihood. Yes. And so this is where I get into questions like, what the heck happened in Canada that we kind of went along with this kind of mindless set of lemons running over a cliff of disaster, hurting our own people, including children, no less. So within Canada, what did you observe there that would have given you a sense that there were a number of voices saying, no, this is not right?
I think the prevailing atmosphere was fear. Mm-hmm. And you can't do anything against fear. When people are frightened, they cannot reason. They won't reason. And I think our media, which really should take a lot of responsibility here. Our media every night, and this is across Canada and the U.S., but since we're speaking about Canada, our media was constantly blaring out statistics, deaths. And if you were not frightened at the beginning of COVID, you were going to be frightened several months in, because you saw all of these statistics that these are real people dying. I think that just upped the fear factor. I think where we really suffered was a lack of really good public information, public discourse, where we needed people to come on camera and be very calm about people's chances. One thing that we never looked at, that the media never looked at, that would have been very helpful, is the risk stratification. Who is actually at risk of dying from COVID? And many of us believed, and I've met many people who believe that their children were as susceptible to dying of COVID as a 90-year-old. And they didn't realize that there was a risk stratification, that the older you were, that if you were over 80, for example, you had a certain percentage risk of dying, and that as you went down, given the average healthy person, that younger people and children, the risk was minuscule. And yet people. So I'm just saying this to illustrate that I don't believe we had enough real calm data, where there's really good public health people coming on the air and saying there's no reason to panic, just be careful, but there's no reason to panic because these are the statistics. The average age of the average old COVID patient is 83 years old. You know, so I think we are really due. I think we need to demand a much better public discussion from our leaders.
I agree. The unwillingness by so many of these leaders to have kind of a public discussion, a reckoning around this, has really been quite another story. And I know there's been a number of us that participated in the National Citizens Inquiry, citizen effort to try to hear from people right across this incredible country of their stories of the impacts that the management of COVID-19 had on people. And it's a really quite an incredible record of those hearings. In fact, there's some more that are going to be starting up in Regina, I believe, in May as well. But it seems to me that in Canada, we have an opportunity now to really learn from this issue, what we did well and what we didn't. My prayer is that we actually have that kind of truth-telling so that you can actually have reconciliation. There's a buzzword is reconciliation in Canada today on many fronts, but you really can't have it if you don't have truth.
Exactly.
So this is all very interrelated, is it not, Vanessa?
Yes. People need to know what the facts are, because as Scott Atlas says in our film, when you have facts, when you have data, then that calms people down. And I think the National Citizens Inquiry, the sharing of all of the personal stories, I think is a heroic effort. I think it's something that the government should have done. If anything needed a royal in inquiry, it's our COVID policies and what happened to us as a nation. I don't think this government is up to it. I don't think this government is particularly interested in it. I think, and obviously that is why citizens took matters into their own hands and held this this very important in inquiry.
I agree. I like that the documentary as well told the heroic stories of so many people, including health professionals, physicians, people from different walks of life that really, despite this fear and despite them even losing their livelihoods, they spoke up. And I think that that is so heartwarming. And I guess my question would be, as you went through this incredible journey to produce this documentary, were there particular things that really surprised you?
I was actually shocked at the level of collusion. At the level of collusion when we told the story of the Biden Biden government getting in touch with Twitter and having the FBI basically tell Twitter whose accounts should be monitored, who should be shut down, who should be censored. To me, that really shocked me that the government, that a sitting government would go to that extent to violate the First Amendment and collude with a third party to silence people on social media. I found that pretty shocking. And the other thing that I found shocking was the fact that we became so blinkered in our health system about COVID. We only saw COVID, that we missed serious illnesses, that we missed, like, for example, in our film, we missed that meningitis case. That's what I think is dangerous. There was a mass hysteria around COVID. But I think had we had a bit more calm, a bit more stronger politicians, stronger medical institutions who took on the responsibility to keep the public calm and reassure the public and say, look, this is what you should do. Keep calm, be prudent, but carry forward. Instead, we did get a lot of fear-mongering, and that is not how you deal with a crisis of any kind. That is not how you deal with a health crisis. It's not how you deal with war. The thing that did shock me is the weakness in leadership. And there's just too much. There is a level of cancel culture. There's a level of left-wing activism. This whole diversity, equity, and inclusion language that is taking over all our institutions. If it takes over our medical institutions, which it already has, then we will not get good health care. We will get checkbox health care.
Well, that's a stunning summation, Vanessa. I'm also struck by those points as well, as the collusion to control information. And by God, you would think that today in our civilization, in light of all our history, we'd understand that no one has a monopoly on truth.
Exactly. And as Jay Bhattacharya mentions in our film, he said, we abandoned science. We forgot how to do science. And I think when we have those slogans such as follow the science, mm-hmm. when we keep hearing those, it just becomes part of us. And unfortunately, there were so many slogans like that we followed and that we trusted in. But most people who are sensible realize that science is a changing thing. It is a living thing. and that new evidence comes up always. And it means that we must pivot. We must be nimble enough. We must be open-minded enough to say, oh, look, there's new evidence here. We better look at this. Maybe we can solve this problem in a different way. And I think part of the issue, certainly coming out of the U.S., was something that Scott Atlas said in his book. And Dr. Atlas said that when he went to the White House, he said he was just shocked just at the level of bureaucracy that was immovable. He said he would bring in all sorts of studies, all sorts of current statistics, because he was in touch with scientists worldwide, and he was in touch in real time with these scientists as COVID was what was raging. And he said that basically that this was an immovable bureaucracy in the White House that was used to doing things in a certain way. And the other thing he was shocked about was that in any kind of medical crisis, when there's an emergency, you get input not just from your epidemiologist, but you get input from your social scientists, from your economists, your health policy people, and you come to a consensus about risk versus benefit. What is the risk? What are the risks to lockdowns? What are the benefits to lockdowns? And that didn't happen. And he was shocked at that. He was shocked.
It really is. It is really quite astounding that this has all happened in retrospect. So there's many lessons to be learned. And I think your documentary is definitely a part of doing that, raising the bar and level of awareness, Vanessa. And so I found it really quite stunning that your premier, you've got one planned, I believe, in Toronto on May the 9th.
Yes.
And you had one planned also for Calgary at a well-known repertoire theater in Calgary, but that was canceled. What happened? Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Well, I heard from my theater rep who was trying to book that theater. He got a heartfelt email from the owner of the theater saying that she had to decline this film. She said because they had come under heavy abuse because they had hosted a town hall for the United Conservative Party. And I thought, well, that's Alberta's ruling party. It's not a fringe party. And she said that that she herself and her staff had come under a lot of criticism from a number of areas. And she said that's why she just couldn't have this film on. She hadn't seen this film, and this film is, as you know, journalistically right down the center.
Really is.
It's a lot of information. There's nothing inflammatory about it. We're not seeking to be inflammatory. We're just laying out information. And so I was shocked, and I thought, I have a screening in Woke Toronto, but I'm being banned in Conservative Alberta. The irony
really
was
bizarre. So here you are. You've planned a premiere in Calgary, and a bunch of yahoos and bullies emerge to try to take it out. And I suspect it has a lot to do with just trying to give that theater trouble, because I think it has a history of actually welcoming a variety of perspectives, because again, no one has a monopoly on truth. But does this concern you that we have, I mean, this is outrageous that this would happen in Canada today, that we would, and I meant this to be ironic, we would tolerate this kind of bully behavior. People who think they have the right to come in and tell us, you can't show that, you can't be exposed to that kind of discussion. Does this concern you that this is happening in our beloved country?
Yes. Yes. I mean, it's, I'm not surprised because I've witnessed a certain amount of cancel culture. I know another documentarian was making a film on Jordan Peterson. This was in 2016 or so, just mm-hmm. when Jordan Peterson was, and she was another documentarian, a colleague, and within her own field. And there were, she was turned down by a number of theaters in Toronto that just didn't want any kind of flack. And right. and so I've seen this. And she was she received severe criticism right from her own field, right from the documentary field, because people in the documentary world or in the arts world, they tend to veer left, and you know that's fine, but I don't want them stepping on my toes, and they shouldn't be stepping on. Mm-hmm. anyone else who's trying to make who's trying to create a film.
Well, this is so very concerning, and I would say that these are not thinking people. These are people who, it's great to have a variety of perspectives on the political spectrum. That's part of our free and democratic society. But it appears to me, and we you know, I would encourage a variety of researchers and journalists to get to the bottom of this. What is really going on here? It's too early to know exactly. But this type of action to, quote, deplatform or cancel parties is really, I believe, very much reflective of a radical left, Marxism,
yes.
a cultural Marxist. You know, I don't want to generalize too much, but this is part of their playbook. And this is very concerning. I think it should concern every Canadian, because what happens is we can't do many things in our society. We can't search for the truth. We can't look for a healthy debate and discussion. And let alone can we undertake science that is so vital for the health and welfare of every Canadian. And I think we're missing the whole plot in this, is that we are making self-inflicted wounds. We are literally shooting off our own feet and well-being, let alone our prosperity, if we can't have this kind of healthy discussion. So, Vanessa, I think that your documentary is a glimmer of hope that, in my mind, tells the story based on solid facts and evidence. And if people want to debate it, they're welcome to do so. But we need debate more than ever, not cancellation. Is that not right, Vanessa?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We need to hear all of the alternative points of view, and we need to hear them expressed in a civil manner, in a polite manner, the way we used to many, many years ago.
Well, well said, Vanessa. I am so appreciative that you have taken your gift and ability to tell story and to be able to, with courage, to share that story with this documentary. It's very moving. I encourage people to look at it. So where is the next premiere? Can you give us details of this?
So the premiere in Toronto is at the Isabel Bader Theatre. I hope that your listeners from Toronto will come out. The film starts at 7 p.m. And I believe you have all of the ticket information. Do you, David? The website is www.covidcollateral.com.
Okay, so be sure to look at the website for those details. And I would urge our family of listeners who are so supportive, an amazing group of people, to support this documentary. I think that paying those tickets is all part of supporting Vanessa Dillon and her incredible team of people that produced this documentary. So be sure to participate. So I want to thank you, Vanessa, for joining us today for this discussion, and wish you every success as this unfolds.
Thank you very much, David. It's been my pleasure.
It's been a pleasure to have you. And thank you for everyone for joining us today in this discussion. And speaking of action, I encourage you, if you believe this discussion is important as we seek the truth together as citizens of this great country, to make sure you share this recording with friends and bring them out to this documentary. Let's rally together and let's support this type of documentary. Let's counterbalance and do what is right to the people, the thugs, the bullies who want to cancel this type of discussion. So again, it's been great to have you join us. Be sure to like us and share it around. And thank you for joining us.